In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, here's a suggestion to start your day off well-informed by tuning in every morning to the outstanding NBC News feature called World News Roundup. It's a program that brings you a complete, concise, and accurate summary of reports from here and overseas. A program designed exclusively by NBC for busy breakfast time listening. Don't forget, start your day well-informed tomorrow and every morning, Monday through Saturday, with World News Roundup. It's another example of NBC's complete coverage of the world for you. Now, stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
McCarthy's censure report will be long and surprising.
Third-party speculation.
The strange case of Alger Hiss, Chapter 2.
Foreign policy on the wing.
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight, you'll hear Earl Godwin, Arthur Barrio, Leif Eed, and Richard Harkness. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to bring us up to date on the national news and what it means. Now, first, here's NBC correspondent Arthur Barrio.
Well, gentlemen, there's a lot to talk about tonight. I was going to start with some talk about politics. But before we get into that, I want to hear what Earl Godwin thinks about the hottest political story we have around here. And that's the Watkins Committee and what kind of report it's going to make.
Well, I think this time next week, that censure report on Senator Joe McCarthy will be history because I understand, I have a pretty good hunch that either Chairman Watkins of that committee or Vice President Nixon will have made the report public by next Monday. It'll be a much longer report than many people would anticipate because the committee of six senators has taken the stand that the Senate is on trial even more so than any individual senator, Senator McCarthy specifically. And for the first time in our history, there will emerge a document which has in it all the documentary references to the laws, precedents, and parliamentary authorities on the subject of the Senate's prerogatives or a senator's prerogatives, and what the Senate and senators can or should not do. In fact, the senators, I understand, are more concerned with the rights and privileges of the Senate than with any individual senator. There's been airtight secrecy on this report, but I'll go out on the end of a limb this time, backed by a long-time coverage of the Senate and House and their attitudes, and I will predict that every one of the 43 charges will be fully reported on. No chance for anyone ever to say that these six senators skipped over any one of the charges which formed the basis for that censure resolution. And somewhere in that report, I predict there will be basis for censure by the Senate of Senator McCarthy, maybe in more than one spot, but just where and on what, we will see if I am right when the report is published, along with the voluminous testimony. I am convinced that the history of the United States Senate in its attitude toward the executive branch of the government will show up in this report as somewhat of a rebuff to the executive branch in the matter of information desired by Congress from the executive branch. The Senate will not relinquish its right to get information. But aside from that, and on the other hand, McCarthy has been accused of the wrong use of material from the executive branch of the government. And in relation to that document, based on an FBI communication to the Army, my prediction is it will not be made public. But I repeat and predict one strong portion of this report will be the Senate's right to information from executive branches, and that, together with conclusions which could justify the Senate in a censure action of some sort, will constitute two highlights, I believe. What constitutes a censure, that's rather hazy still, but the resolution of the senators who wanted McCarthy spanked calls for nothing else. If anyone in the Senate wants to oust Joe from that body, it will have to discuss that under an entirely different resolution. That's all I have on that at the moment.
Earl, I was very interested in your tip as to what this committee report may contain. It's right along the line one that I heard on the Hill. That is that while the committee will not say that McCarthy is guilty or innocent on any one of the five charges, that it will leave the way open for the Senate to censure McCarthy on three points. One, his alleged abuse of General Zwicker. Number two, and going again right to what you were saying, his use of that confidential FBI report in the Army-McCarthy hearings. And then third, his call on government employees to become, in effect, McCarthy informers.
Is that, you've heard that.
I have heard that. I don't vouch for it. It's speculation, but it seems pretty good.
I understand, and I wouldn't. I understand rather hazily that there are three points. What they are, I do not know.
Yes.
But the report will not whitewash McCarthy. Now, the Senate wants to whitewash him. That's different.
That's right.
I heard that the committee was going to present a sort of statement of findings on each of the points. Conclusions. That they would be very definite. It would be definite, all right, and if the Senate wants to do something about them, all right.
Well, it'll be a.
But they wouldn't recommend censure.
It'll be a pocket-sized document.
Very plainly, something's afoot here because
110 pages.
As the news reflects today, the committee will probably make its report early next week. There's a tip out that the Senate will be called into session on September 29th.
Yep.
They're going to button this thing up in a hurry.
Yep.
Which side is going to give if the Senate pushes its demand for information? There's a clash there with the executive.
Neither side. It's been going on since George Washington.
Nothing decisive either way.
No, the Congress has always been demanding information, the right to get anything out of the executive files that they want. I don't know what the basis of it is, that they are the representatives of the people, and they have a right to know what's going on in the executive branch for the purposes of legislation.
Well, the executive branch has always been perfectly willing to give it if it helped them politically.
I think you've noticed that.
Yes, and to keep it a secret if it would hurt them politically. Actually, this stress, conflict between the executive and congressional branches over information, I think is a very healthy thing.
It keeps up
our system of checks and balances. It's generally good.
That's right.
I'd like to know some of the reactions from as we call them, the boys on the hill who are out there and have to come back and face this thing just before election. Imagine they're not very happy about it.
Well, I imagine...
Jim Murray said it would take cops to get him back to Washington.
I imagine that they've canvassed it. This has to be a joint call agreed on both by the Senate and Democratic leaders. However, I noticed that Stiles Bridges, campaigning up New Hampshire, said he didn't want to come back. He thought it was a mistake to get it mixed up into politics at this time, right at the time of the campaign. Alexander Wiley doesn't want a session before the election. He says, mistakenly, I think, that the Senate might get off on a debate on foreign policy. Forget Joe McCarthy and get on that subject.
Didn't the Senate agree to come back 5 days after Nolan and Johnson call him on this, once the committee report was filed? I understand that they said originally, when this was sent to the censure committee in the beginning, they would come back 5 days after they received the call. Now the report is that Nolan and Johnson say that they will call him back, that this issue must be faced, even though it is before election.
Yes, that call would come through Mark Trice, the Secretary of the Senate, but it would be a bipartisan affair.
Well, Mark today was supposed to be contacting officers up on the Hill, trying to find out where these men could be located, so that if the call does come, they can bring them back here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll certainly be a most interesting and I dare say, very hot session.
Well, of course, this is full of politics, as we know. And, Art, what were you saying about something about a political third party?
Well, there isn't a man here at the table, and in the audience for that matter, Leaf, who isn't hearing his share of political rumors and speculation. I found one of these very interesting. A story to the effect that Senator McCarthy is deliberately taking no part in the Republican campaign in the hope that the Republicans will be defeated in November. Well, this, so the story went, would give McCarthy and the Midwest, these isolationists, or nationalists if you prefer, would give them more of an incentive or a reason to get their third party off the ground. Well, all this, as you probably can guess, is based on the assumption that an ultimate clash between the conservative and the more liberal elements of the Republican Party is inevitable. In feeling such a clash is bound to occur, the conservatives are already making tracks in the direction of a third or nationalist party. Well, you can argue that there already has been a clash. But anyhow, this being the case, the best thing, as I saw it, the best thing to do with this was to take the story to a conservative, one of those reactionaries who thinks Mr. Eisenhower has no place in the Republican Party. Also a man who would support a third group. I found him somewhat discouraged. In fact, he was in a mood to predict that there never will be a third party, at least not one composed of ex-Republicans. He said this, "If we ever do organize another group, we feel McCarthy would not be the man to head it. We feel, after some of the exhibitions we've seen," he went on, "that his leadership is questionable. He loses his head too quickly. He's just not the man." A little digging shows the group not only doesn't have a leader, at this point it has no organization whatsoever. It's still in the talk stage, a mere idea, and it has made no more progress than that. I do know this. The subject was discussed with some leading lights among the Legionnaires during their recent convention here, but they offered no encouragement to the would-be organizers either. They had no ideas about how the movement could get started. So the would-be third party seems to be foundling. It would seem that if McCarthy is inactive, campaign-wise, he is so through the desires of the Republican leadership, not through any wish of his own to break away. But as far as the third party is concerned, at this moment, it's about as active as the famous Dodo. Well, may we have the next political rumor. You fellows hear anything about this?
I haven't heard anything about it. I heard some speculation about Senator McCarthy being one of the big wheels in it, but, he's never shown any desire to lead a third party. He's never put up any sort of platform of his own or anything. He's been anti-communist, but nothing else. You don't build a party on one plank.
Well, in this political rumor stage and political speculation, you probably know, there was talk linking him with Colonel McCormick and the Midwest group. Undoubtedly, that's how this thing
started. Well, he hasn't taken any leadership America movement.
Well, a third party on that leadership could hold any convention it wanted to in a telephone booth anywhere.
Sure,
not enough.
I think this third party talk, while it's interesting, just boils down to there being so much political baloney. I remember when I covered the late Franklin Roosevelt back in the late mid-1930s, 1937 and 8, along there. He had the idea of organizing a third party at a liberal party and leading it. There was a certain trial run on it, and it worked in New York City, where LaGuardia headed the fusion ticket. But Mr. Roosevelt, with all his political magnetism, with the big following he had right there at the heights of his terms in office, finally gave up and saw that there was no chance. And, of course, I happen to feel personally that a third party, getting away from our two-party system, would be a distinct setback for the functioning of American democracy.
Well, Dick, as you well know, that after the Bull Moose and after the Gold Democrats, states fix their election laws so it is almost impossible to launch a third party in many of those states. Some places require hundreds of thousands of signatures and things of that sort.
Aside from that, it seems to me that it would, as Dick says, be a grave detriment to the working of our system, because any new party, no matter what you called it, would have to have the same set of broad compromises to fit this whole country that the present two parties have.
Right.
So you just have dividing the power and the responsibility among three parties of compromise instead of two parties of compromise, and the responsibility would be that much harder to fix.
We saw recently an exhibition of a third party in the Henry Wallace movement.
Yeah.
Everybody thought that that would cut into President Truman's Democratic vote in certain key states and would cost him his victory. And Henry Wallace, the party made not one bit of difference in that election. I can't see a third party at all in this country based particularly on this far right wing, call it what you will.
Well, I think we've got something in the current news about that. That Ham Fish, who is one of the big boys in that For America movement, has announced that he's going to quit.
Yeah.
He's setting up for something that I believe he calls the American Political Action Committee. Well, a third party movement has already become a fourth party movement, and it'll probably disappear before the next election.
What's the matter? Was that third group a little too left wing for Ham?
I don't know what I forgot to say about why Ham didn't like him.
I guess we'll all agree there won't be any third party. But Dick Harkness was telling me this morning we're about to hear more from the Alger Hiss case. What about it, Dick?
Well, there is perhaps the biggest and most dynamite laden story of the year developing here in Washington these days. And so far, it's receiving little or no attention. Now, the reason for the lack of publicity is not the fault of newsmen. The administration, it seems, is deliberately keeping this story under wraps, the wraps of two federal grand juries. But we may see shortly, say just before Election Day, since we've been talking about politics, a set of indictments. There may be revelations and charges involving a new wartime communist spy ring, that is, new to the public. One name that we hear spoken of unofficially in official circles is Alger Hiss. The possibility that the government is weighing the rearrest, the recharging of Alger Hiss. Now, frankly, the evidence that comes to hand publicly is circumstantial. But when you take this fact, then pick up that fact, put them together, the evidence does become somewhat persuasive. Now, here's the way the jigsaw puzzle works out. Last fall, as you all recall, Attorney General Brownell exploded his charges about a wartime espionage ring involving, as he put it, the late Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under the Democrat, Harry Dexter White. Well, now, according Brownell,
President Truman promoted White, as you remember, to the International Monetary Fund, despite the fact that Mr. Truman had derogatory FBI information on White. Now, that made it a high-level cat-and-dog fight, and we overlooked last fall the supporting evidence that Brownell produced. He named those that he said were White's accomplices in this alleged Russian spying. One, Harold Glasser. He'd worked for the War Production Board in World War II. There was Edward Fitzgerald, another WPB employee. William Henry Taylor, he's with the Monetary Fund now. And then a Harry Magdoff, who was wartime advisor to the National Defense Council. Now, that was last fall. And coming up to date, today, the Justice Department has not one, but two grand juries going, one here in Washington and then one over in Camden, New Jersey. Now, certainly, by more than coincidence, the witnesses called before these two grand juries are the very same people named by Attorney General Brownell last fall. Glasser, Fitzgerald, Taylor, and Magdoff. Now, Taylor, I think we should bring this out, has denied any link of any kind with communism. But it does seem to me that by any rule of logic, the evidence is here that the administration is going into the so-called Harry Dexter White case and with a view to obtaining some indictments.
Well, this one of these new laws fits on that, doesn't it?
Well, yes, Leif, very distinctly. In fact, I think that's why the White case has been reopened. The Justice Department has that new law passed by this Congress, the one granting immunity to witnesses who would plead the Fifth Amendment. And it should be noted, we were talking about Alger Hiss, should be noted that while Alger Hiss was convicted of perjury in denying peacetime espionage, the White Ring purportedly operated in wartime. And with this new law, perhaps they're getting some evidence on that ring, and there's no statute. This is a point to remember. There's no statute of limitation on wartime espionage. That's where Hiss comes in, of course. And Attorney General Brownell, pointing up this situation, made one interesting point in his testimony on Capitol Hill. He said that, he recalled, rather, that when Whitaker Chambers opened up that fantastic pumpkin of his, that two sets of papers were found, one by Hiss and then one by the late Harry Dexter White, who had just died. So, I don't know. I think there'd be political repercussions. The Republicans, assuming an indictment before election, the Republicans certainly would make a great deal of it and say, you've got to keep us in power. Remember what went on under the Democrats. It was persuasive in 52. Whether it would work again or not, I don't know.
It's one of those last-minute things that you don't have a chance to defend yourself against. Is that what Mitchell was talking about the other day out in the Middle West? Remember, he said he hoped that there wouldn't be any last minute. No, it was here when they were signing the pledge.
The
taking the practice
pledge.
Oh, yes,
that's
last minute thing.
That's famous pledge.
Interesting statement, Dick. It also goes along with the fact that the Department of Justice is having a nationwide grand jury crusade on this FHA matter.
Yeah.
I
would guess that the Justice Department thinks that it has something, because they've had there's been that evidence there all these years. They haven't moved.
I've forgotten about it. What was the evidence that would bear directly
that
on Alger Hiss?
Bear directly on Alger Hiss. The pumpkin papers.
That's one thing. Yeah.
But then Congress passes this new law letting them grant immunity to somebody who does not plead the Fifth Amendment, and all of a sudden Brownell calls not one but two federal grand juries.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just playing. There's something bigger for it.
That Senate committee up in the Senate is, you get them and I get them week after week, these reports on the pattern of communist infiltration. All these names are in there.
Yes, this whole set has run through all that testimony, and I think the whole situation is coming to a head now, and
sure
we're going
do.
To get some big headlines.
You're right. It may be sensational.
It proves rather that national chairman shouldn't sign pledges, you suppose?
Well, I don't know. But it would appear that they expect some person to take this stand in addition to what they've got in the pumpkin papers, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because
they have
to have two witnesses or some piece of evidence supported by a witness.
Of course, that's where the secrecy comes in. We don't know whether any of these people who have testified have talked before the grand jury, whether they've pleaded the Fifth Amendment. I don't know. But there is this parade of witnesses going very quietly. You know who testifies, and then it's swallowed up. But when you put it together, I think it becomes a rather important development, certainly one that we all should watch here in Washington.
Well, action would have to come pretty quickly, you know, wouldn't it? In order for them to elaborate on it in the campaign.
There's a 7 weeks.
A week could be plenty, because they could be all set for this.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it would
Well, remember that they were all set for, wasn't it, Brownell's talk out in the Middle West was all set. They had a briefing on it in Washington. He went to Chicago and exploded. That was a very well-handled thing. So they could be all set for this.
Yes, and of course these are federal grand juries, mm-hmm. which can indict or not indict.
Yeah, indict.
It's up to the evidence the Justice Department has whether or not they'll get indictments.
But usually if they ask mm-hmm. for indictments, they get them.
I guess so, normally, yes.
Mm-hmm. If they feel that they've got a case.
Leif, talking about Alger Hiss, leading him back into the State Department, that, of course, was an issue in the 52 campaign. What do you think of Mr. Dulles' foreign policy? I think he described it as foreign policy on the wing.
Well, it is sort of like that. You know, it reminds me of a word. They used to call them 50-cent words before the war. Of course, there's been a lot of inflation since then, so I suppose now you'd have to tag them at around a buck and a quarter apiece. But there's one word that sort of fits our Secretary of State. It's peripatetic. Yeah, I looked it up. It means walking around.
Mm.
Only Dulles flies around.
In his sleep, you
know? Well, no. This is not somnambulism. That's something else, Earl. But Dulles is the flyingest diplomat the world has ever seen. And always with a statement ready at both ends of the flight. If there's a Dulles coat of arms, it ought to be two wings, four engines, and a mimeograph machine rampant. Dulles flies to Manila to sign the treaty, then he flies back to Denver, then on to Washington, then to Bonn, later to London, and finally back to Watertown, New York, with a statement at every stop. And he's been doing things like that ever since he took over at the State Department a year ago last January. Well, now, some of his critics think that Dulles is running around like a chicken with his head off.
Well, that reminds me, Lee, you say chicken with his head off. In the first place, over in the Justice Department, you know, they're calling him Marco Polo, the way he's whirling around. But did you see that cartoon in the Washington Post, I think it was, the other morning? Mr. Dulles, bags packed, he was rushing out of his office to catch his plane. But there on his desk was his head, which he had left behind.
Yeah.
And the caption was, quoting the headless Mr. Dulles, "Well, you can't remember everything." You think that applies to...
I'm not so sure, because I think that Mr. Dulles has got an idea behind all this. You know, he came to office with the idea that you could sell foreign policy. Sell it to Congress, sell it to the people. So you could get nationwide backing, including the backing of Congress, which Dean Acheson certainly didn't have. Backing for foreign policy. I was behind a long list of Dulles slogans, the ones that sound like advertising slogans, like liberation, agonizing reappraisal, instant and massive retaliation, and united action. Sell foreign policy to the people and to Congress in terms that they could understand, or feel that they understand anyway. Well, now I have an idea that Mr. Dulles is using the plane as much as an instrument of politics and diplomacy as a means of locomotion. The idea that I'll go there and see for myself. That idea appeals to a lot of people. It gives the idea that the big boss is on the job and not leaving these important things to just underlings. And he used a flying trip, the last one, to show that the world that we were solidly behind Germany's Konrad Adenauer and decidedly not solidly behind Mendes France, because Paris wasn't on his itinerary.
Well, Leif, let me ask you, how's he doing with this flying diplomacy of his?
Well, how successful he's been with that flying diplomacy, that's another question. That flight to New Delhi and his talks with Nehru did bring a revival of the then-unconscious Korean peace talks, and finally did lead to Korean truce. But Dulles' numerous flights to Europe didn't stop Geneva, they didn't save the EDC, they didn't bring the United Action when he wanted it. On the contrary, Dulles' most successful diplomacy has been in the Middle East, where he's brought about a settlement of the Suez Canal fight between the British and the Egyptians. He's got the Iranian oil mess cleaned up, and he's brought about an alliance between the Turks and the Pakistanis. In that area, he shored up some mighty weak spots in the free world's defenses. And it's a critical area, too. But this was almost all done through conventional diplomacy, not flying stuff. And you wonder if Mr. Dulles won't be doing less flying from now on, or do you think that flying is just in his blood? What do you think, Dick?
Let me say this as a starter. I certainly give John Foster Dulles A for effort.
Yeah.
He was in office 10 days. He took off on a look-see trip around the world. Meetings, he wants to talk to somebody, away he goes. And I think we're all agreed that it's much more satisfactory for any two people to sit at a table across from each other than it is even to talk on a transatlantic telephone. And then, of course, a lot of these trips, let's face it, too, are completely outside of Mr. Dulles' control. Mm-hmm. He's taking off Saturday for London at 9-power conference on the Brussels Pact in arming Germany. He just gets home, and then he has to go back to a NATO meeting a little later in October. He's not taking these rides just for the fun of it. I think he's about 65 or 6 years of age. He's standing up remarkably well physically, but I think it's a fair statement to say that Mr. Dulles is probably aging 2 years for every one under this physical beating that he gives himself flying.
Well, Dick, why wouldn't it have been just as well to let the things go through diplomatic channels on this last one, to go over and talk to Konrad Adenauer? He could have got the information just as well.
Well,
he couldn't have got a great deal of information, say, in 2 hours, and he just had his boy, Bob Murphy, talking with Adenauer that 2 days before.
Yes, I think that Mr. Murphy went along
that he was using that as a clear
symbol. Well, it does dramatize it.
That's
right. Our secretary of state, that's exactly the point. Adenauer is the head of the West German state.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also important that Adenauer, while he would talk to Murphy, of course, also deals sort of on his own level. I think that's an important thing.
Well, it seems to me, Dick, that the most important thing that Dulles did there was to make a statement when he came and when he left. He said, President Eisenhower and I and the American people are behind Konrad Adenauer. And he sort of gave a back flat of his hand to Mendes France.
That means a great deal to the West German people, too. Secretary of State came over here. He made this statement.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, he told us he was there.
That's what I see.
He's using the plane
as a sort of an instrument of politics and diplomacy.
I think that just at this moment, the Democrats are just building a bonfire. They're going to burn him up if they can. But I think...
I don't know. Dulles' main enemies in foreign policy have not been the Democrats, but more senators.
I think that the people themselves like to see a guy on the job.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think they understand that.
Well, there's something all of us can do, gentlemen, to help this world situation, each in his own little way. Earl, I believe you have that story.
Very briefly, this has been the National Day of Prayer, ordained by an act of Congress, April 17, 1952, instructing the President to proclaim a suitable day each year as a National Day of Prayer on which the people of the United States, quote, may turn to God in prayer and meditation. And so this year, President Eisenhower asked us all on this day to beseech God to strengthen us in our efforts toward a peaceful world. And for the first time, so I understand, the President has also asked the people of the rest of the globe to join with America in this prayer. And the world has been alerted to the possibilities of America's Day of Prayer by the powerful radio broadcast of the Voice of America. And the President, I've been told, has a deep faith in the power of prayer based on an experience of his own when a boy. And it was the President today who led our nation in prayer and meditation in a chapel at the Summer White House in Denver.
You have heard Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Earl Godwin, Arthur Berriot, Richard Harkness, and Lee Feed. Keys to the Capitol will return 2 weeks from tonight.